You are listening to Conversations in the Gospel of John, Episode 5. This episode was recorded in the spring of 2023 at Fringe University in Wichita, Kansas. Welcome to Conversations in the Gospel of John, where we want to bridge the gap between current academic research and contemporary proclamation of this wonderful text. My name is Stan Harstein, and my co-host is Douglas Estes.
I'm Douglas, and I have a PhD from the University of Nottingham in Biblical Studies. I currently teach at Fringe University, and I was a pastor for 16 years.
I've also been involved with teaching and preaching in Baptist congregations for the past 30 years. I currently teach at Fringe University in Wichita, Kansas, and my PhD in Biblical Studies is from Baylor University. We're so thankful that you're choosing to listen to our conversation today.
Today, we're excited to have Chris Skinner with us, who teaches at Loyola University Chicago. Chris, would you like to introduce yourself to our audience?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm glad to be with you. And you're talking about something I care about, which is bridging these two worlds. I am professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at Loyola University Chicago. I also serve as the graduate program director in that department. I've been there for 7 years. Before that, I was at a small Baptist college in North Carolina. My PhD is in biblical studies with an emphasis on New Testament from the Catholic University of America. And I teach classes here on New Testament for undergrads, New Testament, historical Jesus. And at the graduate level, I teach graduate seminars on the Gospel of John, one of which I just finished up last night, Gospel of Mark, Gospel of Thomas, and the historical Jesus. And I was a pastor of a Baptist church in Baltimore for roughly a decade. And have lots of experience, even not as a full-time vocational minister doing work in the church. So happy to be with you guys today.
Well, we're glad to have you today, Chris. And one of the questions we always like to start out with is, what actually caused you to be interested in the Gospel of John? For some of us, that's recent memory, and for others, it's hidden in the past archives of our brain. So tell us about your own interest and story in the Gospel of John.
Yeah, great. It's sort of a long trajectory in terms of getting me involved and keeping me in the field. I started seminary in the fall of 1997, and I was at a seminary that had a very rigorous concentration on the biblical languages. My very first Greek class, the first selection we read was from the Gospel of John. And I just remember being really captivated by the dynamic language, being captivated by the imagery, light and dark, truth versus lie, all of these dualisms. I just remember just being kind of swept away with that. 2 years later, I took an exegetical course on the Gospel of John with a scholar named Paul Harris. In that class, we not only had a sort of a very rigorous treatment of John in the Greek, you know, exegetically from start to finish, but also a very robust introduction to so much of the great secondary literature of the 20th century, which is at the very beginning of the 21st. The works of Ray Brown, the works of C.H. Dodd, the works of R. Allen Culpepper, C.K. Barrett, the list goes on and on. Basically, when I finished seminary and applied to do doctoral studies, I was set that I was going to go and work on the Gospel of John. I studied with one of the preeminent Johannine scholars in the English-speaking world, Frank Maloney, and spending more and more time with him in the context of the class, but also in the context of his office hours, just sort of cinched it for me that I was going to spend my life studying the Gospel of John.
That's great. We'd like to have those family stories. Some of it's an accidental fall-in, and sometimes it's that professor who guides us into that path. So the second thing that we like to talk about, and you get to expound a little bit, is just what lens do you use when you're studying the Gospel? So you're reading John, and I know you have the classes you teach, and sometimes you may use a different lens, but for you personally, when you're looking at the Gospel of John, what lens do you like to use as you're looking through that and beginning to do some writing on that?
Yeah, this is such a great question, and I have to go back into this brief story about when I was in seminary and how we sort of looked at everything through a historical lens. And there's such a value to looking at things historically. But during my third year in seminary, I stumbled upon the work of Allen Culpepper, who was one of the progenitors of introducing a narrative approach into our study of the text. And I was just immediately awakened from my dogmatic slumber, if you will. And I started really moving into the world of narrative and literary hermeneutics and looking at the biblical narratives from the perspective of how we might look at a great work of literature. We look at it as a complete utterance, as an autonomous story that we read from beginning to end, with primary emphasis on the world of the story, but also with a fully informed understanding of the world behind the text. So we do understand how, for instance, the Gospel of John functions from start to finish and tells a very, very different story about Jesus than what we might get in the Gospel of Mark. But also we have to understand, if we're going rather to understand the imagery of the Gospel, if we're going to understand the events of the Gospel, we have to understand it in the context of first century Palestinian Judaism within the Roman world. So I guess you would say I have what I call a historically informed narrative approach.
That's great. Let's break this down. Let's talk a little bit about folks that may be leading a Bible study. Maybe they're familiar with the historical approach. You know, they're reading the Gospels and they know what history is. Why should they pay attention, in your opinion, to the literary part? I mean, is this how do they pay attention to this? What do you think?
Yeah. So in terms of the question, how they pay attention, this is a much more difficult question, and I think it's incumbent upon those of us who have the training that we have to actually help them develop eyes to see how to develop this type of approach. So what's the benefit of it? Well, I think most of the time, and this was my experience growing up in church, and even my experience as someone who had formal training, if you're in a church that has someone preaching from a lectionary or you know reading short passages of scripture each week, you only get a snapshot. Right, and most of the time you're getting a snapshot of a piece from Mark and a piece from Matthew and a piece from John, and what you're getting is these snapshots that you put together into what I call a mosaic Jesus, right? And so we never read these individual narratives from start to finish in a way that shows how Mark might have intended his story to develop from beginning to end, or how John might have intended his story to develop from beginning to end. And once we do that and we compare them, we realize they're telling a story about the same Jesus, but they're telling it in very different ways. They're highlighting very different things. And so I think the real benefit to this is, especially if you're dealing with somebody in the church, in the context of the church or in the context of a Bible study, is that you are helping them to learn how to read, well, how to read for, when I used to teach seminarians, how to read for, we used to call, for information and for transformation. When you only get snippets, you rarely get the broader, the bird's eye view of what the evangelist is trying to communicate with his story as a vehicle for a type of narrative Christology.
Those are some really good images.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I couldn't say it better myself, the mosaic challenge of learning. And what ends up happening is, I think, on the level of the Bible study, is that people create an amalgamation from all these different little mosaic tiles that they hear snippets from sermons and Bible studies and that sort of thing, and they may not put it together well. They may struggle with that. Whereas, as you were saying, that the literary approach teaches us to read. I mean, it teaches us to engage the text from that bigger level. So let's ask this question then. What is a passage in John that you're looking at right now? What is a passage that's intriguing you?
Yeah. So I actually just last night finished the last lecture of the semester with a graduate seminar that I'm doing on the Gospel of John. But just recently, and because of some of the ideas that came up in this class, I've been looking at that first pericope, the first passage in John chapter 20, right? If it's okay with you guys, I just want to just read from it very quickly. Is that okay? If I just
sure.
read a couple of verses very
quickly? Go for it.
Yeah. And I'm reading from the, I guess this is the NIV I'm reading here online. Early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the entrance. So she came running to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one Jesus loved. And she said, "They've taken him out of the tomb. We don't know where they put him." So Peter and the other disciple started for the tomb. Both were running, but the other disciple outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but he did not go in. Then Simon Peter came along behind him and went straight into the tomb. We saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Finally, the other disciple who had reached the tomb first also went inside. He saw and believed. And then we have this, what is in English, rather, a parenthetical comment. They still did not understand from Scripture that Jesus had to rise from the dead. Then the disciples went back to where they were staying. And a couple of things really stood out to me as I was covering this with class, and I think these are things that, especially in the context of this podcast, are things that can preach really well. You have these two figures of major importance to the Gospel of John. There's this question about this sort of intramural rivalry between Peter and the beloved disciple. Is it really a rivalry? Is this really a race? But across 13, 18, 19, 20, and even into 21, you see them together, and they're always in contrast with one another. But in this scene, the beloved disciple stands out to me. And the disciple whom Jesus loved, we call in academic shorthand the beloved disciple, he's become this sort of figure that is to be imitated. Like everywhere you see him, he is saying or doing the right thing. When he is in chapter 13, when he is at the Last Supper and he's leaning back on the bosom of Jesus, or he's reclining on the chest of Jesus. This is the almost identical term in Greek that gets used for the relationship between the Father and Son in the Johannine prologue in chapter 1. When we see him in this situation where Jesus has been arrested, he is inside with Jesus while Peter is outside sort of warming himself by the fire and denying that he knows Jesus. He alone is the disciple who is at the foot of the cross while all others have abandoned him. So up to this point, everything we have seen from him has been either saying or doing the right thing. And then here in this one moment, we see that both he and Peter see the exact same thing, and neither of them see Jesus, and neither of them understand the Scripture. And yet we read that the beloved disciple believed. And it doesn't say anything about Peter necessarily, but it does say something important about the beloved disciple. And I feel like for me, this is paradigmatic of what faith can often be like in the world. We look around and we see remnants that Jesus is here, but we no longer see him. And we often don't understand the Scriptures that attest to what he did, and we don't understand what's going on in the world, but we choose to believe. And for me, that has incredible theological, homiletical, pastoral, personal insights. And so that's really been resonating with me.
Well, I think that it would be great if you can help our audience understand how does the literary method really bring this passage alive?
Because we have the three characters. We can't forget Mary. But you have Peter and... And you're contrasting those two.
And it's difficult to teach on because when we think about it, we can just explain what happened, but there's more to the story here. Can you elaborate, Chris?
Also, a fair amount of the work that I've done in my career has also been on narrative characterization, looking at how characters are presented, how they unfold, what they do, what their significance is. So if we're looking at this narrative from start to finish, we meet Peter very early on in the narrative. Well, we meet him in contradistinction to the other Gospels where he becomes, you are Peter, for instance, in Matthew, you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church. That's at the great confession of Caesarea Philippi, right? But when we meet him in John, the very first thing Jesus does is change his name.
Right.
So that's an important moment from in chapter 1. And we meet this character called the other disciple in chapter 1. Is it the beloved disciple? Some argue that it is, some argue that it's not. But we meet these characters pretty early on. We meet them both in earnest together in chapter 13 during the supper scene. And there is a back and forth between Peter and the beloved disciple. Jesus is predicting that he is going to be betrayed. And actually, Peter looks over to the beloved disciple and asks Jesus, hey, ask him who he's talking about. So we see there that even though Peter and the other Gospels has a tremendous amount of primacy, which we think reflects his primacy in the early church, he still needs to go through the beloved disciple as this intermediary. Right? There's still this closeness that the beloved disciple has with Jesus. And then, again, I've kind of walked you through, you know, when they are experiencing the arrest of Jesus, they have these contrasting roles again. The beloved disciple was inside with Jesus, inside because he's known to the high priest and he's there. And Peter is on the outside, not with Jesus, warming himself by the fire, along with those people who have arrested Jesus and denying that he knows him. And then they're back again in this one scene. And I still think Peter plays an incredibly prominent part. In fact, 21, whether we think it's added later or an original part of the gospel, Jesus kind of reinstates Peter and gives him a threefold opportunity to reverse his previous denial. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Do you love me? Yes. Feed my sheep. But what's important is that the beloved disciple is still this one figure who gets Jesus right at every moment. Now, here's where the narrative payoff comes. This is an anonymous character. He has no name. Now, church history early on said, well, the beloved disciple is the son of Zebedee, is the author of the gospel. And there's still a lot of debate about that. But from a narrative perspective, we don't know this person's name, right? And often in the Gospel of John, characters with no names have tremendous significance. We never meet Mary, but in chapter 2, we meet the mother of Jesus.
Correct.
In chapter 4, we meet this incredible character called a woman of Samaria. She goes on to be the first evangelist in the narrative. She evangelizes her whole Samaritan village. In chapter 20, the beloved disciple believes. And again, we're not saying that Peter doesn't, but we're shining a light on him. So he's always in the right space. He's always saying and doing the right things. And then here he believes, even though he doesn't see. So he, the beloved disciple, as I've said elsewhere, beckons to all of us readers who follow Christ from the pages of the narrative. And he says to us, if you follow Jesus as I have followed him, you too can become a disciple whom Jesus loves. And to me, that's the narrative payoff of looking at this passage from a narrative perspective.
Yeah, that's right. So let me ask a follow-up question. Let's assume for a second scenario here that you have a student who comes to you and says, hey, Professor Skinner, my church has asked me to speak this Sunday or, you know, this Wednesday or whatever, and I'm going to cover John 20. I'm worried I'm going to miss something. What is often missed in this passage when it's taught, do you think?
Yeah, Stan pointed to this a moment ago. What's often missed, and I think what was missed by the early church, is the role of Mary, right? We have these very two prominent people, Peter and the beloved disciple, who've been through prominent throughout the narrative. And we have this Mary Magdalene, who we really only just met at the very end of the gospel. But she is the one thing that we can't miss, right? She's the one who notices that the risen Lord is gone. She is the one who is privileged to receive that first post-resurrection appearance. She is the first one to not only express grief that he is gone, but also the first one to see him and the first one to exclaim that he is the Lord. So to me, even despite what I just, you know, traced this through in terms of this narrative approach, though Mary Magdalene does appear at the very end and is not prominent throughout, I think we cannot miss her because she's the setup for all of the other resurrection announcements and appearances.
And she's only really referred to as Mary at this point, which is interesting, giving the mother of Jesus that. And she was there at the cross, and then she is here, and that's the first introduction. And then she is the first visionary to follow this one. When there's no body, she then, you know, you have those three who don't see, and yet she's the one who sees Jesus and believes and calls him the Rabboni, the very intimate teaching term. So what else do you think this passage might have with Peter and John issues? Because the other place that you did not mention is John 6, where if the beloved disciple has been with Jesus this whole time, he's not mentioned. But John 6 is where everybody leaves, all the other disciples leave Jesus, but the 12 stay. Peter has that confession at that point, and the beloved disciple is silent.
There are all these moments where there are kind of these narrative gaps, and this is another part of reading narratives. There's these gaps that we have to question. First of all, there's this other disciple, and John uses this language as we move closer to the end. He is the disciple whom Jesus loved, and then at one point he's the other disciple, and then by the time we get to 21, he is referred to as the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved. So we possibly meet the beloved disciple in chapter 1, some have argued. But there are these places where presumably the beloved disciple is present, and we never hear his voice. So I think that, you know, there are these interesting places where we have to assume, and that's kind of what gapping does with the narrative, right? It helps us to think about and maybe try to creatively fill in what those gaps are.
I like the narrative gap part because at least on the day after, the time is all collapsed. But even though there are three Passover celebrated, there are a lot of months of the year where we have nothing about what Jesus is doing. And when we read through synoptics and we read through everything, the person who just takes that at face value may think, well, this is all that Jesus did. And yet John makes certain to tell us at the end that there's a whole lot of stuff I didn't tell you. You know, all these other things that I'm not talking about, which are part of the narrative gaps.
I've been very selective. I've only showed you these things so that you might believe. And I talk to my students about this a lot. So, you know, because some of these things circulated orally and because they were passed along and because the church really only kept units of material, the early church, that were expedient for preaching, teaching, exhortation, you know, liturgical stuff within their churches. I often told my students, you know, we never have story of Jesus losing his first baby tooth or Jesus breaking his first bone or, you know, the things that Jesus, what I call the mundane, humdrum, everyday moments, right? So sometimes it can be difficult for us to conceive of them as, well, did he laugh? Did he ever laugh? Because he always seems so serious, right? What kind of, like, what was Jesus' favorite meal? I mean, like, the things that, you know, never come into our mind when we're reading these texts, because like you say, they're mainly focused around, especially in John, either it's Passover or it's a festival of booths, right? Or it's, you know, dedication, these Jewish feasts. And we never see him doing things that are kind of more like what you and I are doing right now, just talking and, you know.
And they walk someplace and it took them a while to get there. So they were having those conversations.
Yeah, if I can just jump back in and say that another one of the benefits of the narrative approach is, since we're only getting snippets in sermons and only getting snippets in liturgy and only getting snippets in the lectionary readings, once you have done a narrative approach and you've looked at this from beginning to end, then when you encounter the snippet the next time, you have a much broader context into which to fit that snippet. And so what it does is it gives you a framework for understanding each of these units in a much better way. Prior to a narrative approach, what you get are only the units in isolation from one another. But what the narrative reading can do is it can give you the entire scope of the narrative, and then you have these sort of narrow swaths that you're plowing as you go through pericope after pericope in sermons or in readings.
Right, and each of us have as an occupation teaching to some degree, and the result of knowing the story allows us to be able to communicate that story better. And so whether you're simply leading a Bible study or doing a sermon or even what we do, the power of that story to communicate and connect people to it is really important.
As we look towards wrapping up, it's an interesting, because we're doing with a post-resurrection and we're recording this. So Easter was a few weeks away or a few weeks before that. But I didn't hear in my worship on Easter, John's gospel being proclaimed.
I have a good story. So let's lay aside Protestant Roman Catholic Easter. I was in Greece for Orthodox Easter last week, and I went to the four-hour Easter resurrection service in the Greek Orthodox Church from 11 p.m. to 3 a.m. On Easter Saturday, Sunday, and it was all in Greek. But the fascinating part is that I was sitting there and trying to enjoy and worship, even though it wasn't the language. And then suddenly, at one point in the service, the pastor gets up, or the metropolitan, I'm not sure, in the hierarchy, gets up and he starts reading, and it was John 1:1 forward, right? The prologue. And I immediately recognized it, of course, and I elbow my wife. I go, oh, that's John 1. And so they preach from John 1 for Easter. That was the Easter text.
That's pretty amazing.
It is pretty amazing.
So we're telling stories. Since you were introduced to R. Allen Culpepper, I did my seminary work and then went to interview at Baylor University. And I was a mathematical student as an undergraduate. And my seminary in the 80s had been very historical. And he was talking a little bit about this narrative approach. And I just kind of went, I don't think that's really worthwhile studying. After spending time with him, and it's like, yeah, it really is far more important. It answers questions, because the historical approach doesn't always answer questions that people ask, but the narrative begins to actually answer questions the people never ask.
We don't want to minimize the importance of the historical. I mean, this is a question that came up last night in my class, because we all semester, it's a 2.5-hour class, so we do an hour 15 on something exegetical, and then we do something thematic. And last night was methodology. And my doctor father, Frank Maloney, always says that it is intellectually dishonest and that it is disingenuous to ask the historical questions without asking the literary questions and vice versa. We're going to look at the world behind the text and the world of the text. All the people that I have learned the most from since leaving seminary and even in my academic career, people like Alan Culpepper, people like Adele Reinhart, people like Andrew Lincoln, people like you guys, right? I love you, like the stuff that you guys have published, have all used what I would consider, what I've described in my own work, as a historically informed narrative hermeneutic. And to me, those two things go hand in hand in a way that really benefits the academy and benefits the church.
And I think the challenge is, as I explained to even my introductory students, historical approaches require a specific set of questions, and literary approaches require a specific set of questions. And if they haven't heard the questions that go with a narrative approach or a character approach or the literary approach, they don't know to ask those questions. And I think part of what we get to do is to talk about that. And in John 20, we could talk for a long time, because after Mary, then you have the appearance to the disciples, then you have the appearance to Thomas, then you have the statement, blessed are those who believe without seeing, and yet Peter didn't believe when he's without seeing, Mary didn't believe when she didn't see, the disciples didn't believe without seeing, but somehow Thomas gets thrown under the bus for not believing without seeing.
Well, let me jump in there real quick, because I have this whole polemic against the Thomas polemic, right? And part of this is, you know, connected to what my own doctoral research was. But Thomas has the most exalted confession in the whole narrative. I mean, he uses the Greek equivalent of Adonai Elohim when he says, my Lord and my God. And by the way, I used Adonai in place of the divine name there, right? Because I have Jewish family. So if anybody's listening, they're like, he said Adonai. I know it's the divine name there, but I use Adonai Elohim because out of respect to my Jewish colleagues. He says the most highly exalted thing in the narrative about Jesus, and other people, like you said, didn't see and didn't initially believe. So I don't think that Thomas is the ultimate dupe or the doubting Thomas. I think he's the one who gets it right at the end, you know? And then that springboard is, you've seen, you've said the right thing. How about all those who won't see and won't believe? And who is that? That's coterminous with Christianity for the last 2,000 years.
That's right. We have to believe without seeing, but we don't have to believe without asking questions, and we don't have to believe without having conversations. Well, we thank you for taking the time to have a conversation with us about the Gospel of John, and we thank those who are listening to us that you will take the time to do that and ask those questions about what is important and how can I engage the gospel in ways that bridge the gap between just studying it and actually living it. Well, we certainly enjoyed that conversation with our good friend Christopher Skinner. Our next episode is the final episode of this series. We'll be talking with Tom Thatcher. Tom spent nearly 3 decades at Cincinnati Christian University. Our conversation will focus on John chapter 21. We hope you'll join us to listen. Bye now.